Okay, for our second session tonight, we're starting at verse 27 of Mark 14. You will all fall away, Jesus told them, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. I don't want to take too long on this section, but that quotation is again from Zechariah. I've been blown away by how many times Jesus refers to the book of Zechariah. When I was studying Matthew a few years ago, I kept coming up against these Zechariah references and quotations and thought, I don't think I understand that book enough to understand why Jesus kept referring to it. So I went and did some study on Zechariah, and it was mind-opening. Zechariah does talk about the shepherd of God's people being struck, and then, of course, the sheep scattered. The original striking of the shepherd happened when the kingship was cut off. But that's a long time before Zechariah wrote these words. So he's talking about the restoration of the kingship in the Messiah, and yet the Messiah is also in danger of being struck and the sheep being scattered. And Jesus reads that as an understanding of what's about to happen this night, when the disciples will not be able to make sense of his program and his understanding of the cross. So it isn't just Judas who's struggling with to make sense of what Jesus is doing. And Jesus tells them, you will be scattered. Remember, I'll go ahead of you to Galilee. We'll come up against that promise again before we get out of the book of Mark. Zechariah talks about the shepherds 14 times in chapters 10 and 11. Tragically, the shepherd is struck, God's flock is scattered, they were sent into exile, and yet the book concludes that God's reign will yet be established. So the last chapter of Zechariah says, Yahweh will be king over the whole earth. And ultimately, that's what happens when the shepherd is struck and God raises him up.
Have you done one of these on Zechariah before?
Did we do a class on Zechariah? No. Would you like one?
Maybe.
I've got a mini commentary you can download from my blog on Zechariah, but we haven't done one of these on it. It's not the easiest book in the world. In fact, one of the early Christian commentators, Jerome, said it's the most difficult of all the Old Testament minor prophets. So it's not an easy one to wrestle with, but it's phenomenal. All right. As usual, Peter wants to argue with Jesus. Even if all fall away, I will not. Truly, I tell you, Jesus said, today, this very night, before the rooster crows and announces that morning has arrived tomorrow, before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times. And Peter is insistent. Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And all the others said the same. Well, we'll see how that goes shortly. 14:32 is Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane. Out of all the times in Jesus' life where he is emotionally vulnerable, this is the one that really strikes me. Sometimes I think Christians imagine Jesus, well, you know, he was God anyway, so he's kind of floating above the ground and completely unaffected by all the things that are going around. When you read the language that describes how Jesus felt, his emotions, this is heart-rending. He went to the place called Gethsemane. Jesus said to the disciples, sit here while I pray. He wants to have time with his Father before this tragic day arrives tomorrow. He took Peter, James and John along with him and began to be deeply distressed and troubled. Is that emotional language? Right? Jesus is not simply floating above everything. He is struggling. In fact, he says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. He's already feeling what's about to happen to him tomorrow, and it's killing him. He asks them to stay and keep watch. Now, why would they need to keep watch? Jesus is very conscious that there's a betrayer, and they manage to finish the Passover meal. They manage to sing the hymn and head out, but some stage, Judas is going to catch up with them. And Judas is aware of this garden spot. So when Judas comes to get him, it won't just be Judas. There'll be a whole herd of people. So Jesus asks the disciples to keep watch. Going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. The anguish of what he's feeling, the awareness of what he's about to face, the death that's about to press down on top of him is too much. God can do anything. So why this? But there's still a heart of submission, even in that pain. Not what I want, what you want, God. I think Jesus waits. He's offered this prayer to the Father. There have been many times when Jesus has prayed. Very often he's come back with a sense of direction. Right back at the beginning of Mark's gospel, there was a night when everyone in Capernaum was so overawed with Jesus. They brought all these sick people, he healed them. And next morning, Jesus knows that this is all happening again. But he goes and has a conversation with his father, comes back and says, nah, let's not wait around for all these. Look, I've got to go to the next village too, because that's what Father has called me to do, right? So he's used to having these conversations with Father and often hearing what Father says. And tonight, there's nothing. Heaven is silent. His father doesn't say anything. Jesus deals with that sense of isolation and loneliness by going back to the disciples to see if he can get some comfort and understanding from them. And they just fell asleep. They've got no idea what Jesus is struggling with. He returned to the disciples and found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch with me for 1 hour? Watch and pray so you don't fall into testing. I know your spirit's willing, but your flesh is like... We were supposed to keep watching in case the betrayer came. Verse 39, once more, Jesus went away and prayed the same thing because he hasn't heard anything from the Father yet. And again, there's nothing. Verse 40, when he came back, he found them sleeping again because their eyes were heavy and they didn't know what to say. So Jesus goes and prays the third time. And returning the third time, he said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? You've had enough sleep. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let's go. Here comes my betrayer. I don't know if you remember from when we did the first half of Mark's gospel the previous term. We observed how whenever Jesus used the word sinner, he was usually responding to something the Pharisees had used. The Pharisees used that label on the people they thought were unfit to be called God's people. And so they were quite happy to point out who were the sinners. And Jesus used the word in phrases like, I haven't come to call the righteous, I've come to call, it's sinners, right? It's the Pharisees' word, because he's not using that label of people. And that's one of the things that challenges me with the language that we use and challenges me to rethink some of the ways that we speak. But here's the exception. On this night, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. And who are the sinners? It's Judas, one of the 12, who's been walking with Jesus all this time. It's the leaders in Jerusalem, the high priests, the Sanhedrin, the elders, the Torah teachers, who are coming to arrest him because they want to kill him. They've got murder on their hearts. And they're the ones that Jesus uses this label for. This is the exception, where it's not Jesus quoting someone else. The people who want to get rid of Jesus, who will kill to be free of his authority. They're the rebels against God, the sinners. Just as well, Jesus isn't like the kings of this world, isn't he? What do you think Herod might have done if his watchman fell asleep? So Judas rocks up. He has made a sign that the first one he kisses will be the one they are to arrest. Now, before you get carried away with worrying about two men kissing each other, if you've ever been in the Middle East, you will be aware of how people greet each other. There's a kiss on the cheek, and most countries a kiss on the other cheek as well. That's what we're talking about, the standard greeting. So in effect, what Judas has said is, the first person I go up to and greet is the one that you should arrest. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priest, the teachers of the law, and the elders. This is the people Jesus has been speaking about multiple times who want him dead. And they have stirred up a crowd of people, some of them armed with swords and some of them armed with whatever they could grasp and operate as a club. The betrayer had arranged a signal. The one I kiss is the man, arrest him and lead him away under guard. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, Rabbi, which actually means my teacher, the one I recognize as teacher. So it's total betrayal as he kisses him. The man seized Jesus and arrested him. And one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Mark doesn't tell us who this was, but one of the 12, at least one, has a sword under his cloak. And again, if you try to picture what's going on here, it's actually fairly horrific. Can I tell it? Can I use the name Peter? John tells us it was Peter. So Peter draws his sword from underneath his cloak and he's heading towards someone, but there's someone else in the way. Standing behind the servant of the high priest would be the high priest. The servant is there to protect him. Peter has got to get the servant out of the way before he can get to the guy who's probably the target. So he gets up with a mighty swing and swings, I think, horizontally to chop off the guy's head. The man sees it coming, ducks his head and loses his ear. It's that close to Peter taking off the guy's head. I think that's what makes the best sense of this text. Peter killing this guy, probably to get at the guy who's behind him. He's determined he's going to fight for his Jesus. Like he said, I will die for you if I have to. He's quite happy to fight. But Jesus is not happy with that. Am I leading a rebellion, Jesus said, that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you teaching in the temple courts and you did not arrest. Why are you doing this in the dark? Why is this a secret event in the middle of it? Do you actually know that you're doing the wrong thing? Why do you have to do it this way? But the scriptures must be fulfilled. The shepherd is going to be struck. I will be struck down and you're the guys who are doing it. And he doesn't allow Peter or the others to use their swords to protect him. In fact, Peter and whoever else was wanting to do that are actually making Jesus look like he is a rebel leader by pulling out their swords. Now, normally, there's two choices that we make when we're really under pressure. It's either fight or flight. Jesus has cut off the fight option. The only other choice they feel they have is flight. So verse 50, everyone deserted him and fled at this point. Jesus won't let them fight. They're going to die if they stay there. Run for your life. Verse 51, a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. They seized him. He fled naked, leaving his garment behind. I honestly don't know what that's doing in the text. It's clear that everyone is deserting. And this guy's got caught. And rather than hang around and be put on trial as a rebel servant of this fake king, he's happy to shed his garment and run for his life. He's a young man with the energy and the strength that he could have fought if he wanted to, but Jesus wouldn't allow it. He can't think of anything else to do but to run for his life. Now, is a reference in Amos 2:16 talking about the bravest of the warriors will flee naked on that day? So is Mark making a reference to that passage in the Old Testament? I don't know. Some of the church fathers in the very early days asked the question, why is this in the gospel? And they suggested that perhaps Mark wrote it in because it was him. Mark's the young guy who lost his jacket, didn't have anything else on, ran for his life because all of them deserted Jesus. Now, I find it pretty horrifying that the temple leaders are coming out armed with swords and clubs. According to Luke's version of it, it's actually the officers of the temple guard supported by this rabble mob who've collected with them in order to come and get Jesus. There was one precedent in the Old Testament where the temple guard had actually done something like this. They, of course, were there to stop Gentiles coming in, to stop non-priests entering the holy space. That they were meant to guard the holy space. But there's a case in 2 Chronicles 23 where a usurper had grasped the throne of David. Her name was Queen Athaliah, and so the temple guard actually took her out of the temple space and put her to death. So in the minds of the priests, there may even be a precedent for getting rid of someone who's a false claimant to the Davidic kingship. I'm going to scoot down to verse 53, where Jesus is led before the Sanhedrin and placed on trial. Sanhedrin, of course, was the highest Jewish council in Jerusalem. It consisted of the upper echelon of the priesthood, the elders of the nation, and some of the experts on the Torah. These guys are literally in power in Jerusalem. They're the ones Jesus is constantly being warning us about. So Mark 14:53, they took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. So he wants to find out what's going to happen to Jesus without being associated with Jesus, because he would prefer that he himself didn't finish up on a cross. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself by the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death, but they didn't find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. According to the law of the Old Testament, someone could not be put to death on the testimony of just a single witness. They had to have at least two, preferably three witnesses, all testifying the same thing, and if their testimony agreed, then the case was proven. The Sanhedrin is having trouble getting people to agree about what Jesus actually said. Verse 57, some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days we'll build another not made with human hands. That is actually a misquote. According to John 2, Jesus wanted the leaders in Jerusalem to be aware that God was now templed in Jerusalem, not only in a building, but in the body of the Messiah. John 1 says, the Word became flesh and was tabernacled among us. The word is skena, the same word that was used for the tabernacle in Old Testament times. God has come to dwell among us in the person of Jesus. That's what the temple was for. It was supposed to be the house where God was dwelling. So Jesus' body was in fact the temple where God was dwelling. And what Jesus actually said, according to John chapter 2, is, you will destroy this body, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. He did not threaten to destroy the temple. So it's false testimony, misconstruing what Jesus said, and their testimony doesn't agree. It doesn't sound like an unbiased trial, does it? They are looking for evidence against, they've already made up their minds that he needs to die. The real issue is that the temple leaders, the anointed priests, reject God's anointed king that God has sent them. They don't want to share power with the Messiah. They don't want to recognize the one that the crowds recognized as the Son of David who's come in the name of the Lord. They can't get testimony against him, so they ask Jesus to condemn himself. Verse 60, the high priest stood up before them and asked, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony these people are bringing against you? Jesus remained silent and gave no answer, which of course riles them because now they've got no testimony to condemn him. So again, the high priest asked him, and some of the other gospels tell us Jesus was put under oath, so he has to answer. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Now, we've talked previously about how those two phrases both mean exactly the same thing. The Messiah means the anointed leader, the Son of David who was to come. And the Son of the Heavenly Sovereign is the one to whom God has given authority on earth So in Old Testament times, David is called God's son. And in Psalm 2, on coronation day, each descendant of David was recognized as the son on earth who bears the authority of his father in the heavens. The high priest is not asking Jesus, i.e. the second person of the Trinity. He's never heard such a thing. There is no such doctrine at this time. He's asking, are you the Messiah? That is, do you claim to be the son to whom the heavenly sovereign has given authority to reign on earth? Jesus is forced to answer. Verse 62, I am. Whew. That's pretty intense. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming with the clouds of heaven. Did we talk about Daniel 7 previously? This is a quote from Daniel 7. It's in the notes for you again. Daniel, in his vision, says, I looked and thrones were set. The Ancient of Days took his seat. And it's interesting that it's thrones, plural. I thought there was one throne in heaven, but there's another one set for someone else who's going to share the throne with the heavenly sovereign. There before me, Daniel says, is one like a son of man, not like the beasts that he said in his previous dream, who will war against each other, kill each other for power. This is someone who behaves like a human, someone who's doing what God intended humans to be in the beginning and therefore inherits the authority God gave humans in the beginning. And he's not coming with an earthly army to force his power on everybody like Julius Caesar did when he sent his army, or like Titus does when he sends an army to destroy Jerusalem in 70 AD. He doesn't come with the clouds of earthly forces. He comes with the clouds of heaven. By heaven's authority is how he will receive his kingship. He approached the Ancient of Days, the one who's ruled forever, and was led into his presence, and he was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and people from every language worship him. So what Jesus' response to the high priest is, I am the Messiah, and you will see the Ancient of Days giving me the kingship, not because I fought you or fought Rome or fought anybody, not with the hosts of earth's forces, but simply because heaven has raised me up and given me the kingship. Does that make sense of what Jesus said? The high priest says, why do we need any more witnesses? You've heard this blasphemy, this absurd, jumped up Galilean with no training in the Torah at all, thinks he is God's anointed ruler. That's an insult to God. What do you think? And they all condemned him as worthy of death. And some began to spit on him. They blindfolded him and they struck him with their fist and said, prophesy. And the guards took him out and beat him. Now, prophesy does not mean predict the future. Prophecy is not prediction. It is speaking by revelation. So what they're doing is they blindfold him and say, come on, tell us by revelation who it was that struck you. If you're really this amazing king, if you really are anointed by the Holy Spirit, then you should have some prophetic gifts. In Old Testament times, when Samuel anointed Saul, Saul began to prophesy. When Samuel anointed David, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily on David, and there are times when David prophesied. If he is the one who's anointed with the Spirit, then he should have that prophetic power. So they mock his kingship by asking him to speak by revelation and declare which of them it was. Because obviously, if King Herod knew who'd struck him, that would be a bad thing to do, right? So does this king have, is he clueless? Does he have any, they're mocking his kingship. They took him out to beat him. Jesus offers no defense. The disciples are terrified. We're going to have to race over this, but basically, Peter is so frightened of a little slave girl, the lowest of the low, that he ends up denying Jesus three times. That's the horrific conclusion, where they have all fled, abandoned Jesus, given up on following him, because they don't understand how to. If they can't use a sword, what are they supposed to do? Stay and die or run for their lives? That's the position they find themselves in. Peter broke down and cried. It was just like Jesus said. He denied Jesus three times. that night before the rooster announced the dawning of the next day twice. Friends, we're nearly out of time. I've listed about five questions there for you to consider what has challenged you in this chapter. But rather than my questions, do you have questions that you'd like to ask before we wrap up tonight?
Didn't the Sadducees and all that crew need the authority of Rome in order to kill Jesus?
The Sanhedrin is the Jewish council.
Yep.
They want to kill Jesus, and they will use Pilate to do it for them. They'll use the Roman power to do it for them.
Could they have done it themselves without that authority?
Look, they say they didn't have the authority.
Right.
Historically, it's a little unclear how much authority they actually had. There were people that they chose to put to death when they felt like it. But it was very easy for them to say, oh, we don't have the authority to, so we need Pilate to do it for us. I think that was convenient.
I've heard that if somebody committed a crime in the temple area, then they had authority to stone them.
That may be the case. They certainly had their temple guards who would not hesitate if it was happening in the temple area. So there may have been limitations to their power. But clearly they are happy to say, oh, but we don't have the power, so we need you to do this for us, yeah. We'll see that happening next week. Ask Pilate to do it.
What do you make of God's silence when Jesus is praying?
Oh, my. The silence in Gethsemane.
Yeah, like, seems so unnecessarily hard of God to do that. And I've heard it's because Jesus already was carrying the sin of the world and things like that, but...
Yeah, I've heard that, so I think that's a bit of a cop-out. There's no evidence of that at that particular point. I don't think I want to make any more of it than what the text does to simply say the emotional and the spiritual state that Jesus was in at that moment was the lowest point of his life. And Father doesn't rescue him. I think that's the main point. So there's nothing that Father says at that point that will rescue him, because this is going through.
Gethsemane is a bit of a tricky one for the apostles. They're confronted by a crowd with not good intent, and then Jesus doesn't want them to fight. There's really not a lot of other options than fleeing.
Fight or flight?
Yeah, yeah.
The third option is the one Jesus chooses, which is to stay and get killed.
Yeah, yeah.
None of them chooses to stay with him.
Alan, in Mark 14, in the arrest scene, the disciples were ready and organised for a combat. And I think this young man was scantily clad in linen clothing. I think he's a runner. Because in ancient warfare, they had a runner who was, and he was usually young and without an armour. And I think the disciples of Jesus were so organised and ready for combat. They had a runner ready.
The suggestion is that the disciples are so ready to fight for Jesus, they've actually got a runner ready to tell the outcome of the battle.
And it's still happening now. There's this reflection of this militant nature engraved into the culture, I think.
The militant approach to solving the problem is exactly what Jesus doesn't do. Jesus takes a completely different view to what the rest of the world does. So you're right, today lots of people are still militant, many religions are still militant, and we are called to be the people of King Jesus who refuse to take that path, who will stand with him, whatever it takes, not with swords, but with Jesus. Radically different. The only Prince of Peace who can save the world, and we embody that in what we do and the way we live our faith. Thanks. That's great, Mendes.
He does say, vengeance is mine, I shall repay.
And so we leave it to God instead of taking it for ourselves. That's the point.
And the silence of the unanswered prayer, there is no answer to this, because the only way is God unspeaking creation.
Unspeaking creation. Yeah. If you want to draw a parallel with our experiences and Jesus, there's a very interesting text in the book of Revelation, where it talks about all these bowls of prayers before the throne of God, and it's like so many people have been praying and they're all still piled up before the throne, not actually dealt with. A little bit later in this is chapter 6, and a little bit later in the same chapter, we get to hear of one example of those prayers. It's the martyrs. have been killed for their faith, and they're going, how long, O Lord, until you avenge our blood? And they're told, hold on, just hold on. So they're still praying in this visionary experience of John's, at least, and they're praying for vengeance, and they're asking God to give vengeance, and God goes, wait. So there seems to be a radical difference between how God runs the world and how humans' understanding of justice works. So the silence of God in Gethsemane is not God's last word. There's another word coming on Sunday morning that changes this completely. But it is not a word of condemnation for the world. It's a word that gives life to his assassinated son, who saves the world. So what God does seems to me to be far beyond what we have hoped for or prayed for or expected God to do. And it's not retribution, it's restoration. But we'll talk more about that next term as we look at the book of Job. One more week in Mark, chapter 15 and 16 next week. If you could read those two chapters, please. See you then.